Session number 10599, relight.
Major I, English Reel 8. With the Battle of Alamein about to begin, Major, what was happening in the way of preparation or knowledge about what you were what your intended role was?
Up 2 days before the battle started on the 23rd of October, and up to a few days before that, we had been given no definite instructions. The commanding officer had been to a large, I think, corps or even army conference when the general plan and general situation was outlined, but specific orders were to come later. And it would be about the 22nd of October, I think, that we received orders that anyway we were to take a fairly minor role in the battle. The main attack was to be launched by 30 Corps in the north with four infantry divisions, and in the south there was to be an attack by 7th Armoured Division and part of the 44th Division and the Free French, and this was to be a secondary attack, and if it ran into heavy opposition, it wasn't to be pressed, which is in fact what happened. But the deception plan was aimed at making the Germans think that the main effort was coming in the south, which of course it had always done in any previous in the desert, because the left was the open flank, although not in this particular case, because we the flank rested on the Katara depression. So we had time to brief all the platoons and all the men, and our orders were that to start with anyway our activity would be confined to patrolling. Well, we received quite good information as to the progress of the battle, partly, of course, on the radio, by which I mean the non-army radio. I think Richard Dimbleby could be, he was a BBC correspondent in Cairo, he could be heard, and also by army channels. And we could listen at night to the battle going on in the north. And it became apparent after about a week that, or perhaps under a week, that this dogfight, as Montgomery called it, was perhaps becoming more difficult than some people had thought, and the problem of getting the tanks out into open country had not really been solved. So orders came to us at midday, I think, on the 28th of October, that the brigade was to move to the north, to an area known as Beachy Head. And that night we were relieved by the Greek battalion on our right, who extended their front. That was the 3rd Battalion of the 1st Greek Brigade. And we set off at 2200 hours and moved to the north in transport. And that went without incident.
Did you move without lights?
Yes, we moved certainly to start with in open formation. That would be about 30 yards between at night, 30 yards between vehicles, and with the intelligence officer guiding the battalion, and one man in each company who had the plan or the compass bearing or whatever it was, and we moved like that. It was with I think shaded side lights, virtually no lights really. And I think the transport drivers had got fairly used to this. And of course, at that particular time, there was a good moon at that time, which helped. But one occasionally went over obstacles and cliff trenches and things which one didn't know until you got to them. And we settled down in the beachy hedge area, digging fairly well dispersed, digging slit trenches, and we had a fairly quiet 2 days. On the 30th, there was a brigade conference to which company commanders were ordered to attend, and the brigadier brought us up to date on the progress so far, told us that the next night the brigade would come under command of the New Zealand division, and that our brigade and the 152 brigade of the Highland division were to do an attack on a front of 4,000 yards to a depth of 5,000 yards, and the objective Sidi Abdel Rahman track. And it was thought that if we could get onto that, well then we would have got through the last of the German defences, and the tanks would be able to get out into open country. And this operation was known as Supercharge. And
in this briefing, Major, were you given maps to show where this place was, this area was, and were you also told of what your support would be?
Yes, indeed. We were all issued with maps, and we were told that the artillery support was going to be on a scale which was greater than anything so far in the war. The two brigades would be supported by a barrage provided by 13 field regiments and 4 medium regiments. And this was, of course, in addition to preliminary counter-battery work and concentrations elsewhere. And the barrage was to move forward 100 yards in 2.5 minutes. So it was going to go on for several hours. Having reached our objective, the 9th Armoured Brigade, which was also under command in the New Zealand Division, was to pass through. Those were the that was the plan, and the brigade commander said that the 8th DLI would be in the right of the 151 attack, 9th DLI left, and 6th DLI behind the 8th in the right rear, to face north rather than west when we reached the objective.
Who was the brigade commander, Major?
The brigade commander at that time was Brigadier Joss Percy, who was a Dynamite infantryman. He had, in fact, been the brigade major at the beginning of the war, went on to command the 9th, and then was promoted to a brigadier. And he had been commanding at Gazala also. Well, on the night of the 30th and 31st, the battalion moved up to an assembly area, moved up to Star Track. Now, there were Army had laid a number of tracks which everyone had to use, and of course they were cleared of mines and were fairly wide. And we moved up Star Track to the assembly area, which was in fact a piece of ground which had originally been the forward defended localities of the 51st Division. And so in fact there were slit trenches and that sort of thing there. And that night, soon after we got there, those German bombers came over and lit the place up with parachute flares and dropped a few bombs, one of which unfortunately killed the adjutant, Julian Parker. At this time, the battalion was commanded by Colonel Jackson, Jake Jackson as he was known, who had come to us at Gazala from the Green Hounds. The other company commanders, beside myself, there was Chris Beattie, who'd been in the battalion since the beginning of the war, commanded A Company, commanded B Company. He joined us at Gazala from, in fact, the Queen's Regiment, I think. The next day, we went up to the Australian positions to recce the forming up place and liaise with the Australians, the 9th Australian Division. And there was a rather amusing little incident. The CO had just been issued with a jeep, of which he was inordinately proud because he was the only one in the battalion. And we stopped this thing and got out just nearer an Australian position with men in slit trenches. And the stories had been going round that if they were left for any time at all, they were purloined and stolen by somebody. And he said to this Australian, he said, "Would my jeep be all right here?" And this bloke looked at him and then spat and then said, "No one will touch the bastard." So this, well, that's the Australians for you.
What was the terrain like that you were viewing and preparing?
Well, it wasn't flat, but it was extremely open. There was little bits of scrub. When you got down on the ground, you could see, in fact, there were undulations and little crests. If you took a quick look at it, standing on your feet, you would say they weren't there at all. But, in fact, these little crests and bits of dead ground and that were extremely useful. And then the ground did rise towards the coast. The Australians had a tremendous battle for some high ground overlooking the coast. And Sidi Adam itself was on quite a feature of ground. By that I mean perhaps 100 feet above the rest.
How far were the Germans ahead of you?
The Germans were probably a quarter of a mile, perhaps, something like that, in front, ahead of the foremost British positions. This varied quite a bit, but I suppose that would be about the general picture.
And outside of the position you just mentioned, was there any other outstanding position that they held which you felt would be a problem, or maybe a problem?
Well, we didn't realize that at that particular time. When the detail orders came down, we were told of a German strong point on our right, and a Maori battalion was detailed to capture that. Of course, the constant British attacks had gained ground slowly, and the German positions had therefore, the ones are in now, had they not had time to develop fully. And they got their 88s, for instance, weren't properly dug down, and they didn't have a full-scale minefield. They had anti-tank mines, certainly, but there weren't many anti-personnel mines.
Were you under any form of observation or attack as you were doing this reconnoiter?
Well, yes, well, to some extent, but one could, if you kept spread out and didn't expose yourself too much, you could move about, and we managed to do that. And when we'd actually finished that recce, we were told that the attack had been postponed for 24 hours, from the night of the 31st of November to the night of the 2nd of November.
Did this in any way bring you any problems, particularly with men being keyed up to something which was put back like this?
No, I don't think so. I think we were quite welcomed it in many ways, because it would give us more time to brief everybody properly and then complete preparations. Now, that night, or no, the next day it was, the CO had his orders conference, and his plan was for the battalion to attack with two companies up, A company right and B company left, and C company behind A on the right rear. And the Maori battalion, which I've just mentioned, was to seize this strong point on the right, which in fact was 500 yards from the start line. And when we had reached the first objective, my company, C, was to move up on the right of A company, so all the ground could be covered. And we then, in fact, should have been attacking with three companies up. The first objective was codenamed Cherry, and that was, I have a note here, of the 865 Easting Grid, 3,500 yards from the start line. And we would halt there for half an hour. The barrage was halted for half an hour, sort everything out, and then move on again to the objective, which was just over 5,000 yards. Now, the boundaries between battalions and brigades were marked by Beaufort's guns firing red tracer, and this was extremely useful. And you could see that they fired, I think, once every 2 minutes. The battalion had two troops of New Zealand anti-tank gunners who had 6-pounders under command, and also a platoon of medium machine guns from the 2nd Cheshire Regiment under command. And in support of the battalion was a squadron of 50th Tank Regiment, 50th RTR in Valentine's. And at about 3 o'clock, 1500 hours, we moved up to the assembly area, which was just east of Telalisa Station, up Boomerang Track. We left there at 1900, led by second in command, who was Major Bob Lidwell, up Boomerang Track again, and for a march of 7 miles up to the forming up place. And this track was at least ankle deep, if not more, in dust. And transport was passed, and we just got completely covered in dust. And we, at the far end, we missed the road, and there was some confusion before we found the FUP, the forming up place.
What was the mood of the men going up? Was the banter or quiet?
Generally quiet. They realised the importance of the occasion, and they realised they were going to be in a fight, and I think most were quiet. We were wearing a khaki drill shirt and shorts and pullovers. And as soon as we stopped, the nights were, well, this was October, the nights were cold, and we really did get pretty cold. They were carrying full-scale equipment, an extra bandolier of ammunition, and every man in the platoon, either a pick or a shovel. We always carried this thing called an entrenching tool, which sat on your rump, as it were, but it was a not really very effective instrument in the desert. It only had a short handle and You were pretty desperate if you had to use that, and we always carried picks and shovels. Arrived at the FUP at 23:30, and we had more than an hour to wait there, where everyone lay around and tried to get some sleep and got cold.
Yeah. Was that marked? Was the forming up line marked?
Yes, yes, indeed. It had been marked by the intelligence officer and his section, and that was marked with white tapes. And indeed, the route into that was marked with white tapes. Now, my plan was to have 14 platoon right, 13 platoon left, and 15 platoon reserve, more or less, between the two. I would be between the two leading platoons with my Batman Private Corley. Now, he was given the job of counting the paces from the start line, which over 5,000 yards at night and being shot at is no mean job. And I was dashing about and talking to people, and he just had to stay on his line. We also had a Private Davis from the intelligence section who kept a check on our direction, and I had two runners. And then the rear company headquarters, which was behind the 15th platoon, the reserve platoon, that's the second in command, CSM, and the rest of company headquarters. We had a bit of a flap. The battalion transport didn't arrive till very late, with things like mortars and supporting arms on, and that was always a worry getting them up. Now, the information about the enemy at that time, we were told the positions were held by the German 90th Light Division on the north side, and the 164 further south in front of us, with elements of the Trieste, which was an Italian infantry division, and behind them was the counteract force of 15th Panzer and Littorio armored divisions. As I mentioned, the German positions really hadn't had time to be fully developed, and we didn't think that we would run into anti-personnel mines, which was a relief. Everybody sighed a breath of thanks for that. That, I think, completes the plans and general picture of the action prior to the attack starting. At 2:45, a rum ration came round, and everyone had a good swig of this, which was very useful. In a normal way, it's useful in those sorts of situations, and also we were very cold. And in fact, we couldn't finish it all, and I gave it the balance to the Australians, who were then coming back from their foremost positions to allow the barrage to go over them. And promptly at 01:05, we crossed the start line in our formation with bayonets fixed. At that time, a pretty dark night, because the moon was well past full. And 10 minutes later, the barrage started. We had been expecting a lot of noise. We heard the guns behind us and the flashes we could see, and then the whistle of the shells going over our heads, and then the enormous crash and clouds of dust in front of us.
Can I very quickly just come in here? Up to the moment of the barrage starting, were things quiet?
Yes, they were quiet. Occasional very lights going up from the Germans. There might be the odd gun firing, but generally speaking, it was very quiet.
So for some 10 minutes after crossing the line, before the guns started, you were basically marching.
Yes, we were quiet. Moving forward slowly, quietly. Yes. This barrage continued, of course, for the next 2 to 3 hours, and the noise really was tremendous. You had to go very close to someone to make them hear what you said, but nevertheless, we realized that that in fact was our armor, that was our protection. And the barrage stood on the opening line for 20 minutes while we closed up, and it had been emphasized, this was the first attack behind a barrage we'd done, and it was emphasized that one should always be within 100 yards of it so one can arrive on the enemy position within a few moments of the barrage passing over.
Was there any feelings that you may march into it as you approach the...
Well, any inexperienced troops, of course, obviously think that. It's actually fortunate that the 25-pounder has a tendency to explode forwards. There were many occasions later on when, in fact, we were fired at by 25-pounders, and... We realized what an effective weapon it was, but nevertheless, we realized the value of keeping close. After 20 minutes, the smoke shells were fired, and this was a signal that the barrage was going to move forward, and this was thought to be a good idea. But in fact, it was a nuisance and caused a certain amount of confusion. And we would have rather not had it, because it was, I mean, we could tell when the barrage was moving away. We continued like this as advance, and we came to a single strand of barbed wire, which we guessed was the beginning of the German minefield, and we did see mines about. And then we came across a German lying down in the open, and he, I think, had been part of a German mining party, and he got up and surrendered without any trouble. And as we went on, it was obvious the barrage was having a tremendous effect. Quite naturally, the Germans and Italians that we came across were pretty stunned, and generally speaking, didn't offer a lot of resistance. But of course, they were good troops, and given some time, or if they had been overlooked, then they sat up and took notice and began to fight their guns and this sort of thing.